So I'm calling to order this meeting of the Standing Committee on Foreign Affairs and International Development. I want to thank members for making themselves available this afternoon on what we consider to be a very pressing issue. And we're going to be dealing with the clause by clause. Pursuant to the order of reference on Monday, December 10, 2018, Bill S240, an act to amend the Criminal Code and the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, trafficking in human organs. So, with that, we're going to move into the clause-by-clause consideration. The chair calls clause one. Is there any debate on clause one? Shall clause one carry?
Yes.
Clause one carries. I'm going to call clause two. Debate on clause two? MP Chesnevsky, I believe that we have several items to discuss here. So please proceed, MP Chesnevsky.
That's correct. These are minor changes, and the purpose of the changes in three places are to ensure that substitute decision makers, guardians, do not unwittingly end up criminalized. So it's just a small refinement to the wording. So more specifically, that in clause two, it be amended by replacing line three on page two with the following: person from who it was removed, or a person lawfully authorized to consent on behalf of the person from who it was removed. So that's the portion that's being added in, did not, and then it continues as it was. The second place where the same change occurs is in replacing line 8 on page 2 with the following: knowing that the person from whom it was removed, and we add in, or a person lawfully authorized to consent on behalf of the person from whom it was removed. And the third place is replacing lines 12 to 15 on page 2 of the following: does anything in connection with the removal of, that's added in, an organ from the body of another person on behalf of, at the direction of, or in association with the person who removes the organ, knowing that the person from who it was removed, or a person lawfully authorized to consent on behalf of the person from whom it was removed, did not give informed consent.
Thank you very much. Any debate?
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Yes. I'm seeing this amendment for the first time, which is fair enough. I know we're all working through this, but I'm reading off the online version that doesn't have the line number, so it was a little bit difficult for me to follow what Mr. Yashinesky is reading out. So, to be clear
do you want to go just do that? Well, you don't have to read the full text, but just where the line numbers are.
Perhaps it might be easier if we have extra copies with the lines numbered.
Are there copies of the bill which have the line numbers in? Because, like I said, the online version.
That would help facilitate with the amendments as we go forward.
I don't believe we have that.
I think
we've got it manually. Manually.
We're all friends today.
Well, at least in this room too. So I hear. Do you have a?
Yeah. Okay. Totally. Okay. So
would you like me to repeat?
So we're on line three. So this is.
So the first place where the phraseology is inserted is in line three on page two.
Yeah.
And the wording that's inserted.
He's got the wording. I think he has the wording. I don't think we need to repeat that.
Okay. So just this penciled version I was given, the lines that are crossed out are the lines that are crossed out in the. Thank you.
Line 8 on page 2, and then lines 12 to 15 on page 2.
Okay.
And the intent is to, as I mentioned earlier, to make sure we don't inadvertently criminalize guardians or substitute decision makers, people who've legally been made substitution, are substitute decision makers.
Okay. Okay, so my comments on this. Thank you, Mr. Yashnevsky, for assisting with the clarification of that. And I have no problem with the substance of this amendment. As a general point, of course, we know that by amending this legislation, this means that we have to go back through the Senate. And I just want to say on the record that that I appreciate the commitment of everyone and every party that we've been discussing this with to move forward. We are moving forward as a committee, it seems, with amendments based on the will of the majority, based on the expectation and the assurance that every effort will be made in the House, in the Senate, to make sure this gets done. And I think we understand the importance of doing that. And I sure hope that there isn't any funny business that happens afterwards. And I know the people that we've been working with across the way, I would not ever think that they would countenance that, but there are many moving parts in the legislative process. So we are moving forward in good faith on an expectation that that all of the assurances we've been given by people in the Senate and in the House are for real. And I think I and others will be extremely upset if that doesn't pan out based on, and I think that means hopefully moving forward with unanimous consent to expedite a third reading and cooperation in the Senate, and I'm hopeful that we can do that. So you know, on that basis, let's make these amendments if they can work, and I sure hope it does.
So. Thank you, MP Jenness. MP Ellis, though, please.
So without contradicting my honourable colleague, I would like to hear from the opposition that the amendments are so significant in structural change that they're so important that we need to make these amendments. Because ultimately I feel that there's a potential for the perfect being the enemy of the good. So there's, you know, clarification and stuff like that, and we all liked wordsmith. But can we argue fully and completely that the substance of this law, this proposed bill, cannot go forward absolutely unequivocally because the amendments we need to do here today are so material significant that we just can't get there from here despite all the work that has already gone into it?
Thank you. MP Chesnevsky, please.
Thank you. And I'd just like to say I share the same concerns that Mr. Jenness has expressed. When he said I and others, I include myself in the others, although once again, and I don't want to belabor this point, I introduced this legislation in its first version 11 years ago. And perhaps more than most, and that some realize, have invested a tremendous amount of my efforts and time and political capital to make sure that this moves forward. As we know, this place can be unpredictable at times, but we've done everything that we can to have predictability and to make sure. This is the fourth time this legislation is coming forward. And in fact, in this fourth version, Mr. Jenness says, you know, I seconded you. I walked across the aisle and sat next to you in the House to show my support. And as Ms. Leslie said, unequivocally, this isn't a place that we can state anything unequivocally, but my goodness, the efforts that have gone on over 11 years to try to get us to this point, and I'm confident we can bring this home. And I believe that the amendments make that opportunity all the more real to make sure that this does become the law of the land in this horrific industry of trafficking human organs, that Canada sets an international example with legislation.
Thank you, MP Eboltaif, please.
In respect to Mr. Rozenski's point, and I, as I said, I have to believe that your heart in this bill fully. My question is usually when people, especially on the government side, comes with amendments, they probably have a reason to do so, and those amendments, just to make sure that on the government side, there's some uncertainty over this bill, and they're bringing those amendments forward just to make sure that they satisfy some members or maybe the government at large. So in respect to that, I think the assurance that my colleague, Mr. Janis, have asked for are, I'm sure you've seen, you hear them very legit and very sincere in a way that we need to make sure that we pave the way freely to this bill to make it through. Without any unfortunate hurts that we would definitely like not to see.
And let me take this opportunity to say that I think there has been the comment made around this table from all parties at the table at every opportunity that this is a bill that this committee considers to be important, and I think we are all working with the goal of seeing it passed in the House. So I appreciate the goodwill that exists around the table and the desire to work using all means to ensure that it receives smooth passage in both places. With that, if there's no more debate on clause number two, on the amendment, sorry. So clause number two as amended.
No. The amendment.
Okay. If there's no more debate on the amendment, okay.
So you put the question. Shall the amendment
carry? Yeah, shall the amendment carry?
Yes.
Okay.
Next amendment.
Okay, and now the next amendment, MP Chesnevsky.
So this is an amendment in clause two as well. And the amendment would delete lines 18 to 23 on page 2. And that clause specifically deals with the definition of informed consent. That's something that consent was referenced in all three of the first versions, incarnations of this legislation, but not the definition. I understand this was a later addition. And with proper intent, sometimes people create some additional challenges. In this particular case, the challenge of just not leaving it talking about consent is that informed consent is a health law concept as opposed to a criminal law concept, and it people much better versed in law and especially constitutional law and the breakdowns between provincial and federal jurisdictions have flagged this. In fact, this is something that was debated and discussed during the debates on assisted dying legislation, and a definition of informed consent was specifically excluded at that time from the government's legislation. So as not to inadvertently cause problems when it comes jurisdictional problems on that legislation, and the same would hold here.
Thank you very much, MP Eboltaif.
The question is, how does this proposed amendment, would strengthen? Strengthen the existing bill. I see that there's a word here, or being reckless as to whatever or not that person gave informed consent under C, if that's going to change the notion of the original bill, I don't know where this is going to really play and really strengthen the bill itself.
So when I first drafted the first piece of legislation, it did take a number of months, and many of these things were looked at. And consent is quite clear; it's understood. And as I said, in my first two pieces of legislation, in the Honourable Erwin Cotler's introduction, that paragraph was not part of it. And I think there was the best of intentions by providing additional wording around it, but it unfortunately potentially, just as it would have with the assisted dying legislation, created jurisdictional issues in the legislation. So it doesn't necessarily add, while it creates potential jurisdictional issues. Now, as I said, I'm not a lawyer. It's just because I've spent so much time looking at these various versions of the legislation. If perhaps the parliamentary secretary, who is a lawyer, feels that there is some greater clarity that he could provide, that would be tremendous. But if that satisfies, if my explanation satisfies, then...
MP Chesnesky, I can also point out that we've got Natalie Levman here, who's Senior Counsel, Criminal Law Policy Section from Department of Justice, who might be, I don't know, MP Abeltaif,
even
do,
better.
Would you like a clarification
sorry,
on the...
Sorry,
would that be helpful?
Mr. Varani.
Not sure if it's better, but... yes, thank you for the question. Defining informed consent in the criminal code for the purposes of one set of provisions and not defining it for others could also create statutory interpretation problems. That's one thing we want to avoid. And the reason why informed consent wasn't defined for the purposes of the medical assistance in dying provisions, well, there were numerous reasons, but one of them was that it has clear meaning in health law, provincial, territorial health law. And what it means is that the patient has to understand and agree to the nature, risks, and consequences of the medical procedure. And my understanding from colleagues who worked on the medical assistance in dying legislation was that the medical community wished for the health law definition to apply and not to have a definition in the criminal code. And because it has clear meaning in law, I would suggest that it's not necessary to define it, and you wouldn't want to define it differently from how health law principles have interpreted it.
Thank you very much, Ms. Levman. MP Jenis, please.
It's kind of the interesting situation we find ourselves in here, because the arguments that were made about why this doesn't need to be in were arguments that were made originally by I think the mover of this bill in the Senate about why the explicit definition of informed consent isn't necessary. So in principle, I mean, my position would align with that proposing the amendment. But I at the same time, what we are doing by removing it is repudiating an amendment that was made by the Senate. Now, it was an amendment that was made in committee, and, you know, I think, I guess, I don't know if Ms. Levman is the best person to answer this, but did you follow the testimony that took place in the Senate committee on this? My understanding is there was a witness who recommended the addition of this. If you have specific reflections on the arguments that they made and why those arguments weren't correct. Also, if you could tell us a little more about the statute interpretation problems that this creates. If this is simply unnecessary, but not doing any harm, then again, it doesn't seem worth risking the disagreement with the Senate. But if there are real legal problems, not just redundancy, that are created, then we should know that too. So,
thank you, Ms. Levin. Please.
Thank you. Those are excellent questions. When you define the same term in one place and for one purpose and not for another, and then the courts interpret that, they may assume that Parliament intended it to mean two different things in two different contexts, and they may be confused as to what Parliament intended. And so it can create some interpretation problems. It's impossible to speculate as to what the nature is or could be of those problems, but we always try to strive for consistency in the criminal code. Consistent approaches lead to consistent applications of the law, so it's a basic criminal law principle that we try to adhere to when we draft criminal legislation. And I have read the record, to answer your first question, and I understand the arguments that were put forward, but it's my understanding that that person maybe was not aware of the fact that a decision, a specific decision had been taken in another context, criminal law context that crosses over with health law principles, to not define that term and allow the provincial and territorial law on the issue to fill in that gap as requested by the community, the medical community.
Thank you, Ms. Levman. Parliamentary Secretary Virani, please.
So just 2 points. One is that I think clarity and consistency and avoiding confusion in the criminal code is an important objective. It's something that I think it's a nonpartisan issue. It's something that all governments strive for. And as an example of that, there are zombie provisions in the criminal code that we've sought to remove, that members of Mr. Genesis' party have sought actively to remove, just for that very reason, because having provisions in the criminal code that are no longer operative or that are inconsistent can lead to misinterpretation of law. So first point. And the second point, just to respond to what Mr. Aboutayev raised, Ms. Levman, if you can let us know, he referenced the fact that informed consent is used in the prior clause in sub A, sub B, sub C. Is it your testimony before this committee that, notwithstanding if the definition was removed, there would be no the ability to enforce these new provisions were they to become law would not be jeopardized? Or phrased another way, does the lack of a definition compromise the ability to enforce this were it to become law?
Yeah, no, I don't believe it does jeopardize the way in which these provisions would be implemented, because it would be the health law definition that would be used to interpret each of these offenses. And as I've stated, the health law understanding of what informed consent means is clear. And what it means is that the patient has to understand and agree to the nature, risks, and consequences of any given medical procedure. And I think that's well established.
Thank you. If there's no further debate on the amendment, does the amendment carry? Okay. We will now move to the third amendment, and MP Chesnefsky, I think this is you two within clause two.
Correct. In testimony we heard earlier this week, and more specifically from Mr. Mattis, there had been some debate around the financial transaction paragraph in clause two. And he provided some helpful insight. He referenced the wording used in the Istanbul Declaration. And I believe it provides, once again, greater clarity. So in clause 2, that we replace lines 28 to 30 on page 2 with the following. Person knowing that it was obtained for consideration for the purposes of exploitation, or being reckless as to whether or not it was obtained for those reasons. And the key wording there is for the purposes of exploitation, and that comes from that Istanbul Declaration. And as I had mentioned, that was a very helpful suggestion from Mr. David Mattis.
Thank you, MP. Is there any debate? Yeah, MP Genis.
Yeah, and this is sort of more of a technical question. Maybe either Mr. Yashnevsky or Ms. Levman or both can comment on this. So when somebody receives an organ in the context of trafficking, they are not so much intending to exploit. They are simply, let's they're simply indifferent to the exploitation, but their intent is to get an organ for themselves. So they're not aiming at exploitation as a core objective. Their objective is to get that organ, but exploitation is part of the process. So maybe there's something in the legalese here that I'm missing, but the term "for the purpose of exploitation" doesn't seem quite as clear. I see the benefit of amending it, but I wonder if something like "obtained for consideration in a way involving exploitation," to me that seems clear in plain English at least, but maybe there's again some legal connotation that I'm missing. So
I defer to Ms. Levman's thoughts on this.
Thank you. That's an excellent question. I think what you're pointing to is a conceptual problem, that you don't understand how someone can purchase something with the intent to exploit, which is essentially obtained for consideration is another way, a technical legal way in contract law of saying purchase. And I would agree that there are some conceptual problems with that language. I'm not sure what it means myself.
Okay. Good thing I asked.
Is there a suggestion on language to be able to address this?
Unfortunately, I'm here to answer legal and technical questions about the bill and the amendments proposed. And I'm not actually sure what the policy objective is with this amendment, which also makes it complicated. So
yeah. Maybe I can speak to that. The concern was, and I felt prosecutorial discretion was sort of sufficient to address this, but the concern was that is there some ambiguity around if somebody was getting expenses covered in the context of receiving an organ donation? Someone's traveling to another place and receiving an organ that's being donated to them, but that person receives. Let's say they have a hotel room and travel expenses paid for them. As part of that process of organ donation, could that be misunderstood as doing it for consideration? It seems to me that they're not doing it for consideration in that case very clearly. They're doing it, they're donating it, and they're getting expenses covered, right? But the question was, could we further clarify this section to ensure that it would not catch people in the net who are receiving organs from somebody who is getting expenses and so forth covered?
I agree that for consideration would likely not cover reimbursement of expenses. That language is contract language, so what it means is a person exchanges something for something else, and reimbursing expenses wouldn't fall within that category in my view, although I'm not a contract law expert. I'm more focused on the criminal law, but I do deal with another provision that uses language like that. So the other issue is the term exploitation, which is a very subjective term. People have different ideas of what that means, especially in context involving vulnerable people. And so you might want to consider that language.
Thank you. I also have a question for Ms. Levin. I'm just going off some notes from my colleague who's the regular at this committee, but consent, regardless of the circumstance in which it is given, is ineffective in contexts such as sexual assault and human trafficking. And do you think the treatment of consent in the context of organ trafficking should be different? I mean, should be in line with those?
Not sure I understand exactly. I mean, in the trafficking provisions, it specifically states that victim consent is irrelevant, and it's a basic principle of criminal law that if you're exploited, and by that I mean by the definition in section 279.04, even if you consented to the conditions which created your exploitation, that doesn't make it not a criminal offense. It's still a criminal offense. So could you clarify a little bit what your concern is about consent?
Well, I mean, there's obviously been some concern raised over, you said exploitation is a subjective term, and I guess I'm just trying to have my thoughts on how we clean this section up. Yeah.
So, MP Saini.
So, Ms. Levin, I mean, I had some concerns about the way this was written, and I used a very simple, but I think a very profound example. You know, immigrating here from India, I have a large family back home and a very small family here. And I think that speaks to millions of Canadians who've immigrated here from parts of the world where large families are the norm. So my question was that if someone from here returned to the sending country, the origin country, and they received an organ legitimately from a family member, whether it be a first cousin, second cousin, third cousin, uncle, aunt, whatever, that if they were to receive that organ, obviously, as you can appreciate, in certain jurisdictions around the world, the healthcare system is not as robust as ours, so you would have to go into the private system to get an organ transplant surgery done. So in that case, I mean, if a family member donates an organ to you, and you obviously cover those expenses, those medical expenses that are required for that surgery, how would that be impacted? How would that process be impacted by what's here?
These are very interesting factual situations, and of course, a court would have to consider all of the facts of the case. And if a court were to consider a case like this were to come before the court, and court were to consider what amounts of money, let's say it's money, were paid in that given situation, and were to determine that merely it was to reimburse those expenses, then my previous comments would hold. I don't believe a court would interpret that as obtaining for consideration. Now, if you were to, one was to pay an exorbitant amount and say that was to reimburse expenses, and the court was to find that it was more than the expenses, the actual expenses, a court might pierce the veil, so to speak, and find that, no, in fact, this was an amount paid for the organ. And this particular offense, as currently drafted, does cover situations where someone merely purchases an organ, regardless of whether the person who sold it consented, meaning even if they consented, as long as they received any kind of benefit for it, consideration for it, the offense would apply.
And if I can just interject, I want to pose something else to you. The Istanbul Protocol, which has been referenced here, which is where the exploitation language came out of, it does reference a number of scenarios where money can change hand, including paying the donator of the organ for lost wages, covering medical expenses, covering medications. There was a number of items listed that would be deemed excluded, which I suppose was the intent of the exploitation language there. How would you, what's your thoughts on addressing that sort of list of possible reasons that money might change hands, none of which go to the root of the kind of exploitation category?
Well, like I said, I do think obtain for consideration has a meaning in law, and that reimbursement of legitimate medical expenses would not be captured by that phrase. I would just like to point out that the Declaration of Istanbul and other health-related instruments, let's say, really are focusing on the non-commercialization principle, which we have in Canada and all of the Human Tissue Gift Acts. There is a consensus that organs should not be commodified or commercialized internationally. Where there isn't consensus is on this type of an offense, where you extend extraterritorially jurisdiction over people, sick people who go abroad to purchase life-saving organs from people they believe are consenting. That on that issue, and that's the criminal law, meaning that it's not a fine, it's not a general civil ban, it's incarcerating people upon returning from receiving an organ while they're healing. There isn't consensus on that, not even in the criminal treaties that we have, which is the Council of Europe Treaty. That treaty specifically leaves it to independent states to determine whether or not they're going to extend their criminal law in that way. And it's my understanding that only a very few handful of countries actually uses the criminal law to address transplant tourism.
Thank you very much. MP Saini?
So,
Just to make this clear, because I gave you a pretty unique example, and the reason I don't want to sort of broaden this out is because this example, I think, really would affect a lot of people. So from what I understand, what you're telling me is that the example that I just gave you, that if someone were to return to this country and whatever, they would not be captured under this legislation.
So we're assuming that the person went abroad, had an organ transplant there with a family member, reimbursed expenses at a reasonable rate, and returned back home. And we're also pretending that this offense is in force, right?
Yeah.
Would you be caught by that offense in that scenario? I do not believe so.
Okay, that's fine. That's fine.
Janice, please.
Yeah, just very briefly, in addition to that, I just wanted to note on Mr. Saini's point that purchasing organs is illegal in India. It's illegal in any of these other countries. So I think, you know, if somebody was, you know, the issue would be, you know, the question that was asked in the House is what happens if someone goes abroad to a place where this practice is legal? Well, to my knowledge, the only country where it's legal to purchase an organ is Iran, and they don't allow foreigners to purchase organs. So it's almost certain that if somebody was running afoul of this law, they would already be running afoul of the domestic law in which they were anyway. So and you have to think about the standard of proof as well. Like, you'd have to pay. I mean, if you were giving a little bit more than expenses, I mean, it wouldn't meet the standard of proof. It would be, you know, if exorbitant, clearly beyond a reasonable doubt, far more money than was changing hands. That's the case where it would be caught in Indian law as well as Canadian law. So I think Canadians that are thinking about the case you're thinking about can rest pretty easy, given that information, given the response we heard.
Thank you very much. MP Chesnevsky, please.
Yes. Having heard Ms. Levin's explanations, I believe that's assuaged some of the concerns that several committee members had expressed at our earlier meeting, so I withdraw this amendment.
Can I seek unanimous consent to withdraw the amendment, please? Thank you. The last amendment in clause 2, I believe that is MP Saini, please.
So I'm going to put on my medical hat for this one. I'm proposing that in clause 2 be amended by deleting lines 34 to 39 on page 2, removing the duty to report. There's several issues with this duty to report. I don't think, you know, when you look at the medical profession, whether you're a doctor, nurse, or pharmacist, that you would break your medical privacy code to report to another authority. I don't think that would be possible. Neither do I think it's necessary. Also, you are encroaching upon provincial and territorial jurisdiction in regards to health, which would be another issue. And the other thing is the way it's written, it would broadly capture organ transplants that happen lawfully in Canada. And you would have to create another reporting authority, which I think is unnecessary. So I don't think the duty to report, I mean, I'll just give you a very clear answer. If somebody goes to get a transplant in another jurisdiction and they come to Canada and they go to see a physician, the physician will not report that. If that patient comes to me, there's very specific targeted medications for transplant patients. I will, under no circumstances, report it. If the person needs medical care in a hospital and a nurse is involved, there's no way that a nurse is actually going to report that. So I think this duty to report is not practical. I think it's going to create another regime, which is going to obviously take up resources. So I don't think that the duty to report is necessary. So I'd say we just remove it.
Thank you very much. MP Janice, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Saini, for proposing an amendment and for, you know, your active engagement with the discussion. I do respectfully disagree with what you've proposed, and I'll just make two points in response. The first is that the exceptions in terms of confidentiality in a medical context, there are already exceptions in law, things around child abuse, around the reporting associated with gunshot wounds. These are things that the doctors do. hopefully they're not necessary to do too often, but there are things that are established in law because we recognize that the protection of vulnerable people at certain points in time exceeds that bond of confidentiality, and I think that's right and appropriate. In terms of the issue of the governor and council designation, there is nothing in this provision that precludes the designation of provincial bodies for the purposes of that that designation, and I think arriving at those designations when and where possible in collaboration with the provinces and territories would be a very reasonable thing to do. But at the same time, this is a question of tracking information for the purposes of the criminal law. So having a recognizing that there's health and there's criminal law, and there's a point where there needs to be a dialogue between the two, and that obviously involves the engagement of different levels of government. We're amending the criminal code here, so to do that effectively, we need to establish the provisions for that designation. But again, I mean, this should be implemented with a good level of provincial and territorial cooperation, including potentially in the process of that designation.
MP Virani, please. Parliament Secretary Virani, please.
Thank you very much, Chair. And in response to this discussion, I just wanted to contribute a few points. The issue of clearly doctor-patient confidentiality is quite sacrosanct. It is pierced on occasion. What has entered into the debate in the context of this bill has been the examples of the duty to report gunshot wounds and the duty to report child abuse that was raised just now by Mr. Jenis, was raised yesterday in the testimony with Mr. Matus. In both of those contexts, it is the provincial legislative mechanism that has been invoked and is used to compel that breach of the doctor-patient confidentiality. Doctors are regulated by largely, almost exclusively, by the provinces themselves in terms of the College of Physicians and Surgeons, for example, in Ontario, in terms of setting standards of practice, the oaths that are taken, the licensing requirements, etc. And in respect of sort of federal, provincial, territorial sort of suppleness, for want of a better phrase, in terms of being able to adapt to amendments that might happen here, the FPTs have actually not been engaged on this bill to date. So I think that's important to inject into the context of this committee's deliberations.
Who's up next? Garnett. MP Jenis, please.
Thank you, Mr. Varani, as well for your comments and your engagement on this. I would just say that of course there are many examples of federal statutes, probably the most famous being the Canada Health Act, that do touch on matters to do with health. And I think the fact that federal parliament, members of parliament are engaged with these issues to some extent already is reasonable and reflects, I think, the kinds of conversations we have with our constituents in terms of being engaged with health matters. But again, the reporting mechanism is left to governor and council. So this is something that can be arrived at, I mean, obviously, private members' legislation. There's not a mechanism for us to be actively engaged in negotiations with provincial counterparts at this stage. But this is the sort of thing that is pretty common sense. And I think something significant is lost by removing this section. What is lost is clear certainty that we will have an effective mechanism for identifying and prosecuting effectively those that are involved in this. So I think, with respect, it is a workable mechanism, and it is very much worth leaving in.
MP Senni?
I respectfully disagree with Mr. Jenis. I can just give you a personal example. In the House of Commons, I have patients or I have people who have asked me for medical advice on the opposition, on my own benches, serving staff, police officers, and sometimes administration staff, sometimes the bureaucracy. So I have a wide range of people in Parliament itself. And the reason I say that is because nobody will ever know who those people are. There is something sacrosanct in medicine that no law will change. To suggest that a law is going to compel someone to do something, especially in the medical profession, that is the one thing that we keep very, very close to us, is that medical professional relationship. So putting it or not putting it, I can tell you practically, it's not going to work. It's better just to remove it and not cause any further complications to the passage of this bill.
Parliamentary Secretary Virani, please.
I just think it's, you know, it's entirely appropriate that this committee, among others today in Ottawa, are talking about confidentiality. But when you sort of underpin, you sort of explore what confidentiality is meant to promote. I mean, it's so clear that sometimes we don't think about it, but it's there to promote people coming forward, right? We keep these things confidential because so that someone feels that it's not going to be shared with another person, so they can talk about their depression, they can talk about their anxiety, they can talk about whatever health issues are plaguing them to their pharmacist, to their doctor, whatever the case may be. And that's because we want people to get better. We want them to safeguard their own health. That is a fundamental imperative that I think supersedes any objectives that have been articulated otherwise, and why it is so sacrosanct, that doctor-patient relationship. And I think that's important for this committee to underscore.
Thank you. MP Janice, please.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. With great respect, I don't think anybody here is debating the importance of confidentiality in a medical context. My wife's a physician. There are many physicians in my family. I know it well. I know the importance of it well. I think all members do, and all members understand the critical importance and exactly what Mr. Virani said about why. And there are also exceptions in law which are designed to protect the most vulnerable, so that if a child is being abused, that child can be protected. That fundamental concern for justice for the innocent supersedes that principle of confidentiality. It's not to deny its importance, but it's to recognize the need for those exceptions, again, that already exists in law. And it's hard for me to understand why it would be suggested that this case, where we have we have instances of people's organs being taken from them, vital organs, while they're alive, simply because of their political convictions, or in other cases being exploited because of their poverty, that we would somehow not automatically equate that with the other forms of abuse where we already have these exceptions in law. It's not something new. It's simply extension of a, from my perspective, very clear-cut moral principle. A few other points. One is that this was an amendment that was specifically requested by the Senate and supported by the Senate to add this section in, and I think it was very important. All of the previous versions of the bill from Erwin Kotler, I believe Mr. Yashnevsky's as well, had a reporting mechanism in there, because if you want to get this done, if you want to protect people, then there has to be an effective reporting mechanism that creates a possibility of prosecution. And there is no sense in which facilitating the prosecution of heinous criminals like child abusers undermines the wider principle of physician-patient confidentiality. So I really hope we don't pass this amendment because I won't repeat myself. That's enough. Thank you.
Very much, MP Jenis. Seeing no further debate on this point, I will bring it to a vote. Does the amendment as debated pass?
No.
All those in favor? Five. All those opposed?
Mr. Chair, I'd like a recorded vote on this then.
Do that.
The vote is on the amendment.
Sorry, just a point of order, Mr. Chair.
Yes, MP Fergus.
I would have loved to have. I'm not a member of this committee, and I would hate to break the normal relations which happen on this committee. But it's my understanding that once a vote has been taken, if it hadn't been called to have a recorded vote, then the vote's actually done.
I will ask the clerk. I'm told that it is fine. It can either be before or after the vote, but as long as it's asked for, we will allow it.
The vote is on the amendment of Mr. Jasnevsky, or sorry, excuse me, Mr. Saini. Mr. Fergus.
No. Excuse me.
Mr. Saini.
Yes.
Mr. Sidhu.
Yes.
Ms. Vandenbelt.
Yes.
Mr. Jasnevsky.
Yes.
Mr. Abultaif.
No.
Ms. Alislev.
No.
Mr. Genuis.
No.
Mr. McGregor.
No.
Thank you. The amendment passes, and we will now go to the vote on the clause 2 as amended. Sorry, Ms. Levman.
I don't want to hold you up, but I just wanted to point out, because you've removed the definition of informed consent and retained the financial transaction offense, you do have a numbering problem. It's very minor, but it goes from 1 to 3 to 4.
Yep. Thank you for pointing that out. We will address that right now.
And in sub 4, it should say 1 or 2. So just a little tiny technical thing.
Thank you. Okay, so the renumbering will be reflected when they reprint the bill, but we shall go back to clause 2 as amended. Those in favor of clause 2 as amended? Thank you. Those opposed? 1. Thank you. Okay, so it passes. Clause 3. I don't believe there's any changes that have been put forward. Any debate on clause 3? Ms. Vandenbelt, please.
I just have a question for Ms. Levman. It refers to the minister, and just wondering if it needs to specify which minister.
Thank you. I believe that's an excellent question. I am not an expert on the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, but there are experts on the IRPA in the room. Would you like to hear from them?
Okay, yes, if we can call the IRPA expert in the room just to answer this question. Thank you. And MP Vandenbelt, I'll have you re-ask the question of our new guest. Welcome.
First, to in the opinion of the minister, and my question is whether or not there's enough clarity about which minister, or does that need to be specified?
You can just leave it. It's fine.
Thank you. There's no need to indicate which minister. However, we have noted that in the summary it refers to the Citizenship and Immigration Minister, but in fact the minister responsible for Section 35 that's noted in Clause 3 is the Public Safety Minister. There is no need to specify which minister because we already have provisions in the Immigration Refugee Protection Act that set out which minister has responsibility for which provision.
Thank you very much, Ms. Afshar. We will, so hearing that, I think there is no need to provide further change there. So on Clause 3, shall Clause 3 carry? All those in favor? Yes. Thank you. Shall the title carry? Favor? Thank you. Shall the bill as amended carry? Thank you. Shall the chair report the bill as amended to the House? Those in favor? Okay. Thank you very much. And with that, we shall adjourn. Oh.